Privilege of serving as president of the Pound Civil Justice Institute. And this afternoon, the Institute is proud to sponsor the 6th annual Howard Twiggs Ethics Lecture on Legal Professionalism. This lecture is given annually as part of the AAJ Convention's advocacy track, and it is given in honor of our late great friend and educator and role model, Howard Twiggs. Howard, as you know, was a president of both AAJ and the Pound Institute. He was an outstanding trial lawyer from North Carolina, a distinguished public servant. He was a benefactor of his community and our profession, and most importantly, he was just a wonderful human being by any measure. He was known as the consummate peacemaker, and I think that this annual lecture in his name is very aptly named. The Pound Institute, if you are not familiar with it, is a legal think tank supported by the Consumer Bar, the only one, and it's engaged in outreach to the judiciary and legal academics. We have a lot more information about Pound that's available on the website and also outside. I think there's also some information available at your chairs, and we'd love to have your support and involvement in Pound. So let's get on to the lecture. This year's 2016 Twiggs Lecture is presented by Stephen Bright. And Stephen Bright's topic is eliminating bias in jury selection. Following Professor Bright's commentary, or his lecture, we will have commentary by Judge Janet Stumbo of the Kentucky Court of Appeals and Michael Wolfe, the Dean of St. Louis University School of Law and formerly the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. Let me share a little bit about Professor Bright before he begins. He grew up on a cattle and tobacco farm in Kentucky, and he earned his BA degree from the University of Kentucky, where he was elected by the student body and became known as their first liberal activist student president. After graduating from the University of Kentucky College of Law, he worked in legal services as a public defender and as a director of the law school clinical program. He served as a director of the Southern Center for Human Rights from 1982 through 2005, where he developed a national reputation as an opponent of the death penalty and an advocate for the right to counsel for poor people. He has been the president and senior counsel at the center since 2006. Professor Bright has taught at Yale Law School since 1983 and has published numerous essays and articles on the right to counsel, racial discrimination in the criminal justice system, judicial independence, and many other topics. He has represented people facing the death penalty at trial and on appeals and post-conviction review in state and federal courts for over 30 years, including the United States Supreme Court, where he has successfully argued three capital cases involving racial discrimination in the selection of jurors. The court found discrimination in all three cases, including the most recent, Foster versus Chapman, which was decided just this past May. He has also brought class actions to remedy human rights violations in prisons and jails and has challenged inadequate representation provided to poor people accused of crimes. And as part of his work at the Center for Human Rights, Professor Bright was instrumental in the creation of a public defender system in Georgia through the passage of the Georgia Indigent Defense Act. Professor Bright has received numerous honors and major awards from the American Bar Association, the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association. And his work has been the subject of documentary films and books. I'm sure you can understand why we are so excited to have Professor Bright here with us today, and I will now, with no further ado, welcome him to this podium. Professor Bright?
Thank you very much for the very generous introduction and congratulations on completing your year as president. I'm honored to give this talk in remembrance of Howard Twiggs and to share this with Judge Stumbo and Dean Wolf. As you can imagine, if we're going to have a response, it's going to be a fairly short lecture. but at this time of day, that's probably good. And as you can also see, we were a tad bit optimistic in naming the lecture, which was Eliminating Racial Bias in Jury Selection. It probably should be named The Hopelessness of Eliminating Racial Bias in Jury Selection, since we've been on a journey to do that throughout the history of the country and don't seem to be any closer now than we were a long time ago. I'm asked to give just a little bit of a backdrop of this, and I will do that. Many of you are familiar with the cases and know it, and I want to talk just a little bit about the case I argued at the court this last year, although it will make one of the points I want to make, which is that you have to have such extraordinary facts to prevail so often on these cases. But as long as the country's been around, there's been an effort to keep juries white and male, and to keep racial minorities and women off juries. That's slowly but surely changed over the years when finally African Americans and other minority groups were allowed in the jury pools and women were allowed in the jury pools. With gender, it's about a 50-50 balance, so there's less opportunity to do what happens so often with regard to race, which is to exclude a group altogether from participating in the jury process. In 1965, in what was the Warren Court Revolution, when Miranda and those cases were being decided, a case came before the Supreme Court called Swain versus Alabama. Robert Swain had been sentenced to death in Talladega, Alabama, and his claim was that never in the history of Talladega, Alabama, had an African-American ever served as a juror, and that was because the prosecution in these criminal cases was striking them off. That did not bother the Supreme Court. In an opinion by Justice White, the court said this is what peremptory strikes are about. You can strike based on religion, based on race, based on a hunch, based on the way a person looks. As Thurgood Marshall said later, an open invitation to further discrimination, which has continued until this day. But exactly 30 years ago, in 1986, the Supreme Court decided a case that was supposed to do something about this and probably made it easier, if anything, to discriminate on the basis of race, and that was Batson versus Kentucky. The court had gotten scathing criticism over the fact that this practice continued of excluding people of color from participation on juries. And as many of you know, in that case, Justice Powell, writing for the court, said, well, instead of having to do what Swain had required, which said if you could show that in case after case, over a long period of time, no matter what the defendant, no matter what the issue, that there was a systemic exclusion so that African Americans never sat as jurors, you could make the claim. But of course, most people can't put together. We did, actually, in a case. We won a Swain claim. It's the only one I know of, by showing that over a fairly long period of time, this prosecutor had a remarkable history of striking people. But most people can't afford to do it, don't have the time to do it. It took us 2 years to do it. So Batson changed that by saying that if there's a disparate number of strikes in the particular case, the other side, whichever that applies to everybody, applies to plaintiffs, defendants, prosecutors, criminal defense lawyers, that if it's a disproportionate number, then the striker has to give reasons, and the reasons can be any reason as long as they are race-neutral reasons. That has proven not to be very hard. Thurgood Marshall pointed out at the time Batson was decided that almost anybody would be able to think up a reason to give, and I think that's pretty much been what the history has been. But the other part of it that many of you know in firsthand experience is so difficult, and as Judge Mark Bennett pointed out, is that what you're really asking for is two findings from a trial judge who probably deals with that prosecutor all the time. One, a finding that that prosecutor intentionally discriminated on the basis of race. And some people take that personally when you accuse them of that. And secondly, that the person lied to the court, that instead of admitting the real reason for the strike, which was race, They made up a reason or gave another reason as a pretext, so the reason would be upheld. As Judge Bennett points out, there are very few trial judges who are going to make that finding, and particularly where I practice, usually the judge was the prosecutor and struck all the blacks himself before he became the judge and his chief deputy became the prosecutor. So the likelihood that he's going to find intentional racial discrimination is pretty unlikely. And so we have seen very little in the 30 years since Batson was decided, trial judges, although in the South we have a lot of trial judges who don't ever seem to find a Batson violation when an African-American is struck, but they do find Batson violations when white people are struck. We had one state senator in Georgia who was prosecuted in federal court. The prosecutor struck all the blacks. The defense struck a number of whites. The federal judge upheld all the, did not overrule any of the strikes by the prosecution. So all of those were upheld, but found three Batson violations with regard to the defense strikes of whites. You almost never see a Batson case with more than one Batson violation, but if you have a very racist judge who's determined to get to a certain result, Batson does give the judge that power to do so. One of the things you talk about is doing away with peremptory strikes and giving a lot of power to judges, but Batson also gives judges a lot of power. The Illinois Court of Appeals said in one of its cases when it reviewed a Batson issue, it said, and now we come to the charade known as Batson. Surely every prosecutor's office distributes a list of 20 handy-dandy, time-proven, race-neutral reasons. Now, they were being sarcastic. But the fact of the matter is, and this probably happens on all sides in cases, that's exactly what happened. What happens? The North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys had a program on selecting jurors. They had a one-page handout that was titled Batson Justifications Articulating Juror Negatives. And what they did was give you a pre-approved race-neutral reasons. Too young, too old, attitude, air of defiance, often a reason for striking black people. Lack of eye contact with the prosecutor. Eye contact with a defense lawyer. Body language, arms folded, leaning away from the question. And then my favorite, boredom. You know, maybe your jury selections are more exciting than mine, but I don't know that I've ever had a case where the jurors were riveted to the jury selection. But boredom can be a race-neutral reason. And a judge in North Carolina found that a prosecutor there had used these just, you know, when they'd strike a black, they'd just look down at their list and read off a reason. Four different capital cases. So they weren't the actual reasons, they were prepackaged reasons. And if all Batson stands for is that a lawyer, after striking a person of color, just looks down at a list and reads off one of the reasons that's there, it obviously means nothing at all. The North Carolina trial court found after they had aggregated, and you know, in a case you have, let's say, 10 strikes and eight are against, or maybe you only have, in my case, you only had four African Americans, so all four were used to strike the four blacks, or maybe five, or whatever it may be. But it's not a lot of numbers that we're dealing with. But what they did in North Carolina was aggregated all of the strikes in death penalty cases, as long as they'd had the death penalty. So now you're talking big numbers, and these become a little harder to deny. And the trial judge found that the North Carolina prosecutors strike African Americans at double the rate that they strike white people. If they have a African American there, more likely to strike than if they have an opportunity to strike. The likelihood of this happening at random is 1 in 10 trillion. But no sooner had Batson been decided than people tried to figure out ways to get around it. Batson was decided, as I said, 30 years ago, 1986. 1987, Jack McMahon, a prosecutor in Philadelphia, had a training session for young prosecutors in which he told them to strike on the basis of race. Even though the Supreme Court had just said you're not supposed to do that. And he told him, he said, now when you have a black juror, you know, you question them at length and you write down so that you can give reasons. You want to write down as much as you can so that you'll be able to give reasons. Well, that remained within the bosom of the prosecutor's office for some length of time until Mr. McMahon decided to run for district attorney against the incumbent, who at that time was suddenly overwhelmed with an ethical duty to disclose the videotape of this training session. Because after all, it did appear to be intentional race discrimination, and she wouldn't want that to go on, even though this tape had been made about 5 years earlier. So she called a press conference to show how ethical she was and released the tape. And of course, several cases, both in the Pennsylvania courts as well as in the Third Circuit, once you added this tape, you had the pretty strong evidence of race discrimination. The case that I had was the same year, 1987. And these two court-appointed lawyers in a little town called Rome, Georgia, when Batson was decided, and they had this capital case, they put together a motion, and it said, the prosecutors in this circuit have always struck all the blacks. Always have. We know that in our case, they're going to do it again. But the Supreme Court decided this case, Batson versus Kentucky, don't let them do it again. And the judge, of course, said, well, we'll get to that when we get to that. And they had some discussion about it beforehand. Never any question that there was going to be a Batson hearing. I mean, not like there were going to be blacks on the jury. It was just a matter of when we were going to have the Batson hearing and whether we were going to let the blacks go home during the jury selection process. Well, they gave 9 to 12 reasons. They basically did something that's a tactic some people employ, 9 to 12 reasons for every person and hoping that something would stick. Maybe not all the reasons, but some of the reasons. And that was upheld by the trial judge. It was upheld by the Georgia Supreme Court. We got into the case 20 years later, and we made an Open Records Act request, and amazingly, sort of like getting that videotape in Philadelphia, we got the prosecution's files. And just real quickly, here's what we found in it. We found that on the list of all the jurors who had been called, that they had all been, this is only one of about 8 or so pages, that out of all the people, all the blacks are highlighted in green, and there's a little key at the top. It says green equals black. And just in case anybody was colorblind, there also was a B beside the name of every black. And it was circulated around the prosecutor's office to see what information they could get on the blacks. Apparently, circulating a racially coded list was not unusual in this prosecutor's office. Then we found the way the district attorney had marked up the jury questionnaires. He seemed to be more interested in race than anything else. Then there was another place where they had listed the black jurors as B1, B2, B3, and so forth. They had ranked the black prospective jurors against one another and had memoranda in the file that said, well, Ms. Harge might be the best, or if it comes down to picking a black, maybe Ms. Garrett would be okay. That was one of the things that the prosecutor said. If it comes down to picking a black, maybe Ms. Garrett. But the fact of the matter was Ms. Garrett, who was one of the four African Americans in the jury pool, was never going to be on this jury. And the state had said that they had considered her to be questionable. But other things in the file made it crystal clear that that was not true. There was a list, you see on the far side there, of the definite no's. These are the people who are definitely going to be struck. And the first five are African Americans. And the sixth is a white woman who was opposed to the death penalty. And there are none after that. These were the five African Americans, one was excluded for cause the morning of jury selection. And then on the various lists of jury We knew exactly, or they knew exactly, how the jury selection would take place. The judge would call the name. Each side would either accept or strike. It's no going back. And so they knew exactly when they would get to each juror, all the black jurors marked for being excluded. And then some of the reasons given, well, this was one of the reasons given for striking B1, Mr. Hood, was that he was a member of the Church of Christ, and that the Church of Christ was adamantly opposed to the death penalty. Well, here the district attorney's files, can't quite see at the top there, Church of Christ takes no position on the death penalty. So they knew at the time they represented that he was a member of a church that was so adamantly against the death penalty, they knew that wasn't true. And then down lower on the page, that no black church underlined with regard to the Church of Christ. Some of the reason, one of many, for striking Ms. Garrett was that she avoided eye contact. The way in which the prosecutor stated this was sort of an awkward way of articulating it, but we found the reason for that was because it came verbatim from a case. This was actually not his reason for striking. This was the reason for a U.S. attorney striking somebody in the Southern District of Alabama. I guess this is sort of like Ms. Trump's problem this past week. He appropriated that reason. And then in his closing argument to the juror, and this we did know ahead of time, he urged them to give the death sentence to my client, Tim Foster, in order to deter people in the projects. Tim and his family lived in the projects. 90% of the people in the projects were people of color. So there's a couple of interesting things real quick. This is what Ms. Garrett said later. The African-American woman who was struck, about how I was a single parent trying to take care of my children. They kept asking me why I had two jobs. You know, I had two jobs because I had two children and I was a single parent. And then when I sort of got mad at them or when I got defensive, they said I was indignant, which is why a lot of another reason given often for striking African-Americans. They also said that it was because a relative of hers had been arrested for a drug offense. But that reason was given at the motion for a new trial, and actually that arrest didn't take place until after the trial, so it couldn't have possibly been a reason for striking Ms. Garrett. But Justice Sotomayor's reaction to that was very interesting, the fact that the prosecutor didn't ask any questions about it. She said, well, I have cousins who've been arrested, and I have people in my family who are in jail, and I don't know very much about them or where they are. So how close was she to this person? Not often that we see members of the court sharing the fact that members of their family have been in jail. Eddie Hood, B1 there, said, when I came home, I told my wife there are not going to be too many of us in this jury. The professionalism and ethics point on this is when you have this happen, it's pretty obvious to everybody the corruption of this process. Everybody knows they were struck because of race. Everybody knows the reason given are lies, and yet the judge and the prosecutor, the lawyers, all go along with it. And even the jurors who were struck, the black people, knew good and well what was going on when they got struck. I had another case in the Supreme Court a few years ago in 08, Snyder versus Louisiana. Same thing, Jefferson Parish, Louisiana. And we said in our brief, you know, the African Americans in Jefferson Parish know that they're basically disenfranchised. They're never going to sit on a juror because the prosecution always strikes all the blacks. And the white people know it too. And the legitimacy and the credibility of these jurors, when people are excluded on the basis of race, is undermined when that happens. Well, obviously, this is an unusual case. This case was called Foster versus Chapman. It was decided in May. But it does help in some ways, I think, because multiple reasons. A case in Florida in which the reason given for striking a juror was she was a young black woman and the defendant was a young black male. Doesn't really sound like a race-neutral reason. But then the prosecutor said, but also some of her answers to the death qualification questions. I didn't feel comfortable. Not that she was opposed to death penalty, but I didn't feel comfortable. Florida Supreme Court said, well, the first reason obviously is not race neutral, but the second reason is, so it's okay. And then the case went to the 11th Circuit on federal habeas, which upheld it on the same basis. I think it'd be harder to make that argument after Foster, because in Foster, if you give 9 to 12 reasons, some of them are going to be legitimate reasons, or at least race-neutral reasons, and some of them are not going to be. The other thing was the court was very vigorous, and Chief Justice Roberts wrote this opinion. It's a very, even though it's a clearly erroneous standard, it's a very aggressive analysis of the strikes and how they were used and comparing blacks who were struck with similarly situated white people who were accepted by the jury in that case. So even under that standard, there is a place for courts to play that role if they want to. I don't see many state courts that do, but if they did, you certainly have that argument. I think it's very difficult with the trial judges because of the psychological factors I mentioned a moment ago. Finally, I would just say this. For a case that's not quite as extraordinary, our case, there was the case Miller L. out of Texas, in which you just had every sort of thing imaginable showing race discrimination, including a manual that said strike the blacks. I mean, that's a pretty good indication of racial bias. But the Snyder case, which was decided, as I said, in 2008, Allen Snyder versus Louisiana, 522 U.S. 472, and it's cited in the materials, is pretty much closer to a sort of garden variety jury selection. The prosecutor struck all the African Americans and based really on jury comparisons of looking at the African American who was struck and the white people who were accepted. An opinion by Justice Alito, of all people, the court held 7-2 that there was a violation. The other thing I would say just out of this case is that it just shows what's out there if you go look for it. Of course, most of the time the prosecution's going to shred their notes after the jury selection. I'm sure this prosecutor would have, but he had some financial problems with the government and he had to leave office. And so by the time we got around to requesting the notes, there was a new prosecutor and they didn't go in and purge the files. So we just, again, in the Philadelphia cases, in our case, it's just serendipity. I mean, we learned these facts. Compelling facts, 7-1 decision by the Supreme Court. Once we got past the procedural issues, no question about the Batson violation. But if these notes had been burned or shredded or some other way kept from us, Mr. Foster would be executed about 3 or 4 years from now. So it was critical for him. It doesn't seem like a very principled way to decide issues just based on who finds, who turns over the rock and finds the smoking gun evidence. But it is out there, so I'd suggest looking for it. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Wolf. This is a terrific topic, and I'm really glad to be here. And a terrific work that Steve's done his whole career around these issues. I hearken back to what I learned about jury selection when I did some trial work on plaintiff's side years ago, and that is we would figure out who were our jurors. What kind of jurors did we want? We wanted African Americans. We wanted people of Italian descent, people of Irish descent. We wanted union members, and we can get into the gender categories too. We wanted working people. The defendant wanted people of Germanic background, Nordics, people who were in management. So we use those things because we have a relatively short period of time to make judgments about who are going to be our favorable jurors. But race comes into play. And around this time, and it was I think about 40 years ago, about 10 years before Batson, one of my colleagues was doing appeals for Attorney General John Danforth of Missouri in criminal cases. And St. Louis County was kind of a hotbed for this problem, as many counties like it are. It's a suburban county with some developing, trending demographic shifts. Back then, it might have been about 5% or so black. Today, it's probably closer to 20%. Most of the Batson cases that I saw when I was on the Supreme Court of Missouri came out of that county, one county. But back 40 years ago, when they were starting to get sensitized to this, the guy who was doing this work with my colleague said, well, the prosecutors have a rule to avoid being accused of racial discrimination, and that is, leave one. Well, think about that. And then Batson came along and gave us this three-step process that I think has so ably been debunked here. One of the cases that's in Steve's paper is a Missouri Supreme Court case, McFadden, which actually was 2012. It was a year after I left the court. And the interesting thing is that my successor wrote the opinion, an African-American judge on the Supreme Court of Missouri, and he upheld a strike against a Batson challenge. But what was kind of interesting about the case is that there were four Batson trial challenges in the trial court, and the trial court overruled the prosecutor on three of them. And I was wondering, whoa, are people starting to get this? And I'm not sure. What are they learning? Well, it may very well be that sometimes what you'll see is that it may very well be that the trial judge, rather than becoming a very elevated person, conscience-wise, may have seen this is a case where the evidence of guilt is so overwhelming, why should I screw up the record by going with the prosecutor on what are obviously about as flimsy Batson excuse as you can find? So I'm not sure how much progress we make. And the other thing is that in capital cases in Missouri, you have 9 peremptory challenges for the prosecution and defense. And so you can do a lot of things. By the time you do 9 for the prosecution and a similar number for the defense, where is your representative group? So the question that I come to, besides the one about, obviously, are we kidding ourselves with the Batson formulation? And so the question that comes from that is, if we are kind of kidding ourselves, if this is just a ruse, why should we keep it? Because we have, I agree with Steve that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to see that Batson is going to solve a problem. Justice Thurgood Marshall saw that too in the Batson case, where he said, what we really need to do is get rid of peremptories. And so did Justice Breyer some years later. And so did Judge Mark Bennett, who wrote the piece that Steve referred to on implicit bias in jury selection. But from the standpoint of the trial bar, if I stood up here and said, well, let's just get rid of peremptory challenges, how many of you would want to escort me out of the hotel? I'm not asking for volunteers. But seriously, you have to kind of think about that. And then you think about, well, what is the effect of that? If we didn't have peremptory challenges, every one of us who's tried jury cases would say, oh, I'm screwed now. But the other thing is that we would have to then think about what's the effect on trial judges? Because you know how far you get in challenges for cause? Not very far, usually, okay? And so if you're going to eliminate or cut down the number of peremptory challenges, you really have to have a more relaxed standard for excusing people for cause, because that's where you can make at least some plausible showing to the court that this person, because of her background or her preferences expressed, ought not to be sitting on this jury. Those kinds of arguments get very little play, as you all know, from selecting juries, because there's the peremptories. Oh, just go ahead and use your peremptory. Well, if you don't have any peremptories, then you have to get serious about what it is that you're doing with jury selection. I offer that as a I offer that as an alternative. It comes to you from Justice Marshall, from Justice Breyer, from Judge Mark Bennett, and sort of from me, okay, with a lot of caveats. But it would probably take about as long to get us educated into how to do this without peremptories as it's taken us to find out how to fool ourselves about Batson. Well, actually, that only took about 5 minutes, but it took a long time to figure out if we could make it look right. And I think that's really what the lesson of the Chapman case is, that the court said this one looks so bad that we can't have a system that looks that bad. And I think that, we really want a system of justice that doesn't just look right, but is right. Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is not the best time of the day to speak, I don't think. Last thing in the afternoon before you all go and enjoy yourself, so I'll try not to put you to sleep. My name is Janet Stumbo. I am a Court of Appeals judge, and I've also served on the Kentucky Supreme Court, our highest court. So I have heard a lot of appeals. But oddly enough, very few of them have had Batson challenges in them. It's just not something we see, which is, I think, aside from Batson, obviously, we are a very homogeneous state. It's the minority population is small. But what I wanted to bring to you, and the point I wanted to make, is that I think you have to go back further than stepping into the courtroom when you start thinking about your juries, and we need to take action on this. Is that how are your jury pools decided? Who, where do they come from? Where do the names come from? In Kentucky, it's from driver's licensing and voter registration. That leaves out a whole lot of people in the inner cities because they don't drive, leaves out a whole lot of people who are just apathetic, don't believe that voting is an important thing, or that it means anything to them. So we have got, as the legal community has got to figure out a way in your own state to make more minorities and more people of color from every walk of life part of these jury pools. We recently had a case, and I sit on my state's Judicial Conduct Commission, the disciplinary body. And we have a case that is coming up for a final trial where this African-American judge walks into his courtroom, and there's the jury pool there, prosecutors there, defense counsel's there with his client, and he looks at the jury pool and he says, "I'm sorry, we're not going to have trial today because there's not a single African-American person in this jury pool." Now, no one had moved to dismiss the jury. No one asked. He just did this on his own. Well, the prosecutor was very upset because he has nothing to do with choosing who the jury pool is. That's purely done by the circuit clerk's office from a list of people that's generated in Frankfort, in the state capitol. They just pull out the list for each county and send them to the circuit clerk's office. So the prosecution, and I think rightfully, says, "Judge, we're here to try this case. The defense hasn't objected. There is no proof that there's been any sort of tampering or any problem with this jury pool. I want to go ahead and get this trial over with." And he just says no and walks off the bench. Then he does it again the next day or a day or two afterwards. And he just will not try any cases. Then he became very angry when the prosecutor filed a motion to recuse him from all the Commonwealth's cases because he's not going to seat a jury unless the jury is to his liking, unless the jury pool is to his liking. Now, he went kind of crazy, and there's all this stuff on Facebook and all these comments in the paper and to the news reporters that has gotten him into potentially a lot more trouble than his actions in the courtroom. And in fact, you could make an argument, I think, that a judge has a duty to make sure that the trial is fair and that the jury pool at least is representative of the community. But can he do that without any request to do so from anyone else? So that was my first thought when I was asked to participate in this, because it's something that we all need to think about and look at when whether you're doing plaintiff's work or defense work. We need to improve the ability of the court system to get a jury pool that is representative of the community. We have in Louisville, there is a commission that was set up to study why there were fewer African Americans serving on juries than the statistical percentage of African Americans in the city. And what we've learned is that it's because young people don't vote, young people ride the bus, and in particular, young black men are more likely to have a felony conviction that prevents them from serving on a jury. African Americans in general have higher conviction rates, but in particular, the young men. And so those three facts skew against having a jury that represents the community. And that's just something that we're going to have to deal with as a as the legal community. I was also thinking about talking with my husband last night about this topic, and he said that he's a trial attorney, does a lot of trial work, and he said he doesn't even look at the race anymore, doesn't look at the racial composition of the jury. What he wants to know when he is doing voir dire is, what news shows do you watch? Do you watch Fox or do you watch MSNBC? Particularly if he's got a case against a corporation of some kind, or say a medical malpractice case, or any other type of profession is being sued, because there is a big difference in the point of view of these people. We've all been brainwashed to an extent by our own choices in what kind of news and what kind of politics we follow. So I think he's got a point there, too, but that's a personal thing to each people. I don't see any challenges for watching Fox News. I don't think that's going to happen. But that's really all I wanted to say, and we all know the law on these issues. We know how it should be, but we need to work on making jury selection more fair and making our jury pools much more open to obtaining a diverse pool to choose from in the first place. So that's all I need to say. Thank you.
We have a few more minutes before our time runs out. I know people are probably about ready to go, but if you have any questions, comments, whatever, we'd welcome them. Yes. Well, as someone pointed out, Justice Thomas has a different constitution than the rest of the Supreme Court. I mean, I think that's true. And basically, deference to the states trumps everything. And so this was a really remarkable case when you looked at how strongly the Chief Justice wrote the facts of the case. I mean, clearly said the prosecutor lied, the prosecutor misrepresented. I mean, it's as strong a case as you could have. And, you know, a lot of people, you can imagine that maybe Justice Scalia, had been alive, would have said, well, this is so far out that this isn't allowable. Well, Alito did. But because it's not going to really affect other cases. But for Justice Thomas, no. There is no bats and violations in his universe, I don't think. I guess probably because he didn't have bats in at the time the Constitution was written. Yes?
Maybe I'm being cynical, but isn't the real holding in this case the write down?
Well, that's always the fact. Yeah. The question is, isn't the real holding in this case, don't write it down? Well, sure. As I said, we were just very, very fortunate. What had happened, and this district attorney had left office under a cloud. A new district attorney came in, got appointed to the bench, now third district attorney. So when we requested the records, that district attorney had no idea what was in there and didn't look. I'm sure those notes wouldn't have been in there if they had. But as I said, that doesn't seem like a very principled way. Which is probably why these bets and issues should be scrutinized more carefully the first time around, because I think there was probably a basis for the Supreme Court to declare a Batson violation the first time around. I mean, the trial judge can't. I mean, not only did we have the factors that that Judge Bennett's talked about and that I've talked about, this guy's got to run for re-election. I mean, they're locally. A death penalty case, and he can't find a Batson violation. So the only hope is with the state appellate court. Actually, the two reasons they found for striking one of the jurors, neither one was true, which was not that helpful later on. So
there's a question over here.
Nothing that I can cite to. There are a few cases on that. The question is if the person is struck because they're gay, or if the argument is made, the person struck, there's an objection, this person struck because they're gay, just like to strike a black person, objection, this person struck because they're black, and then, of course, the striker, the person who strikes, gets an opportunity to say, no, that wasn't the reason I struck. I struck the person because whatever it may be. Of course, the example you give where the issue is intertwined or might be, then you've got a little bit different situation there. But in terms of being able to give you just off the top of my head any cases or whatever, I don't know. There's also been a religion case or two. I don't think that's a winner ultimately, but there have been where a prosecutor says, I mean, if you're a prosecutor in death penalty, I know I'm too criminal for this audience, but you're trying a death penalty case, and one of the jurors is Catholic. And the prosecutor says, I struck the juror, white juror, struck the juror because they're Catholic, and the Catholic Church and the Pope and everybody else is opposed to the death penalty. I don't think this juror will vote for the death penalty because of religion. That would seem to be a case-related reason for doing that. But not everybody would agree with that.
I had a case, when I was on the court, we had a case where the prosecutor struck an African-American who happened to be a seminarian. And the reason was because he was so religious.
Uh-huh. Right.
And a majority of our court said, that's okay. I said, well, the Missouri Constitution is pretty clear about the right to serve in government and on juries and so forth is not conditionable upon religion. So,
and of course, part of that too would be what were the questions on voir dire? Could the person put aside whatever the views are? We have, you know, Tim Kaine saying, I'm a Catholic, I'm opposed to the death penalty adamantly. I was governor of Virginia, 11 people killed on my watch while I was governor because I wasn't going to let my personal religious beliefs keep me from doing what I had to do as a government official. Yes, sir. Well, I think what the judge did in that regard, as long as that's all he did, and this was in Louisville, Kentucky, and it has a fairly substantial African-American population, not large, but substantial. There should not be not a single person of color in a veneer that's sent to a courtroom for jury selection. I think he's well within his rights, or any judge is, to say, this is not representative of the community. I'm going to send him back, and I want a different veneer sent in here. Where he got in trouble was when the prosecution disagreed with him about this, which was pretty predictable that he would. He then wrote a lot of stuff on Facebook, which, if you're a judge, I would strongly advise against writing on Facebook about a controversy that's before your case and for your court. And I particularly would advise against calling the prosecutor a lot of names. Because, you know, makes it look like maybe you're biased, you know. Yes?
Were any disciplinary actions brought against the prosecutor in the case he had the Supreme Court? And if so or not, what role does the violation of the
Good question.
What role does disciplinary procedures have to then?
Well, you know, none whatsoever. In fact, you know, nobody thought this case had anything going for it until the decision came down. You know, everybody says now, wow, on those facts, no wonder you won. Well, you know, have the case for 28 years, and nobody had said that before the decision came down. And, of course, if the Supreme Court had denied cert in this case, we would not have had a chance in federal court because of the deference that the federal courts give to the state courts. So he almost certainly would have been executed. The prosecutor, my experience with the bar or association, I'm really sorry to say, on these kinds of things, on defense lawyering in even capital cases. We executed a person recently in Georgia whose lawyer was drinking a quart of vodka every day during the trial. My friends tell me that's 21 shots of vodka a day. I would have trouble functioning if I had 21 shots of vodka a day. But they held that he would have didn't make a difference and executed the client. And no, he was disciplined, but for stealing money from clients, not for that. And we've had a number of lawyers, I'm sorry to say, a very high number of lawyers who've missed the statute of limitations. Seems to me as basic as it gets. I mean, you all may think differently. But to me, what's more basic than filing your papers on time? And we've had now over 100 people in death penalty cases whose lawyers have not filed their federal habeas corpus action within the statute of limitations. And the result of that has been they get no federal review. They get no review by life tenure judges. They just get, if you're in Alabama or Texas, you know, those judges just come on the battlefield to shoot the wounded. I mean, they're not going to look at the case, and there's no chance the case is going to get so the federal courts are the only place where there's going to be any possibility of vindication of constitutional rights. And yet no action. One of the things I've been raising hell about is that those lawyers keep getting appointed over and over again. Even after they've missed it once, they get appointed again and again and again. What's going on? The judges have to know. They have to know. But that's a different point. Yes, yes.
Thank you.
They have a little different standard on Batson. Well, the standard is abuse of discretion. I mean, excuse me, the standard is clearly erroneous on appeal. But you did remind me of something I want to say, and Judge Wolf pointed out that, you know, there are not that many of these Batson cases going up. And I think a lot of lawyers have decided that Batson is hopeless, and there's no point raising it. I mean, it does make the other lawyer mad when you raise it. I can tell you that from experience. It often makes the judge mad if he and the lawyer are buddies. But my view about it is Batson is just a lottery. Buy a ticket. The chances that you'll win are about as good as winning any state lottery that's out there. But this case shows there are going to be those times when you things fall into place and you can win these cases occasionally. And Alan Snyder was a case like that, which was not a particularly unusual case. It was a trial in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, that's represented by David Duke in the legislature, not really the friendliest place in the world, wouldn't let the people from New Orleans come across the bridge when the Katrina hit. So if you're a black guy, it's not a great place to be tried, and they always struck all the blacks from jury selection. But it was a garden variety case, and many other people tried in Jefferson Parish. The prosecution struck all the blacks. The cases were upheld on appeal by the Louisiana Supreme Court, and they either went to prison or went to the execution chamber, wherever it was they went. But somehow this one guy somehow managed to get cert granted in the Supreme Court of the United States and gets his death sentence set aside. And the same thing for Tim Foster in Georgia. I think we now are out of time, so thank you very much. Great to see you. And
all right. Really enjoyed that.